一再都听你话，不怕你说不怕你一样那黑黑的话。
From KCRW and McSweeney's, this is The Organist. I'm Andrew Leland. And a note to younger listeners or more sensitive listeners, this episode contains explicit language. Today, we'll hear from Tommy Pico. Tommy Pico's poetry juxtaposes pop culture, gay culture, and Native culture. But actually, to say that he's juxtaposing these things at all does his work a disservice, because the subject of Pico's poetry is unstable. In a recent poem, for example, called Junk, the title refers maybe to a lava lamp in a thrift store, but then it seems like it refers maybe at the same time to indigenous history in North America, but also it seems like it's referring to a piece of anatomy that belongs to an anonymous hookup he's having. So these elements that collide in his poems are at odds with each other, but they're also inseparable. His poems move from sexual confession to political outrage to pop music obsession, sometimes in the space of a single line. So, we'll hear from Tommy Pico in just a minute, but first, I want to introduce the second installment in a new series we're calling Verbal Selfies.
I'll tell you this, I was never attracted to Johnny Depp. Don't make fun of other people's idea of interior decoration.
I'm going to tell you another thing. Every single human being from Nebraska makes excellent casseroles, and that is something I value.
So the way these work is, we ask artists and writers and listeners and whoever, you could do one. We ask these people, including you, to record moments from their lives. Anytime during the day, just hit record on your phone or whatever and capture a moment or an idea and send it to us.
I'm definitely going to be Aaron Spelling for Halloween this year. Looking forward to that.
This is Robin O'Neill. She's an artist based in LA, and she makes monumental, intricately detailed drawings using a mechanical pencil. She often draws men. Usually they're wearing sweatsuits. Usually they're drowning or dying or seem like they might be about to die. Sometimes they're doing exercise. And as a result of this laborious work, she spends a lot of time in her studio.
I can't think of the last time I left my studio. I'm working towards my next show. So I am just drawing nonstop. These drawings are tedious. So what do while I do it? Some people listen to music. I do occasionally. Other people, maybe they have other people in their studio. They're talking to them, not me. I like to be alone. But I love hearing people talk. So normally I listen to very talkative TV shows. Oftentimes it's like Beverly Hills 90210. I've watched the entire series, all 10 seasons, at least 7 times, I would say.
In one of the clips she sent us, Robin describes a quote that she's got tacked to the wall of her studio.
When you're in the studio painting, there are a lot of people in there with you. Your teachers, friends, painters from history, critics. And one by one, if you're really painting, they walk out. And if you're really painting, you walk out. And that is Philip Guston remembering something he thought John Cage said to him. That's all I got tonight. Have a good one.
And I like the verbal selfies Robin sent us because I think they give us a chance to hear these voices that the artist hears when she's alone in her studio.
I have ulcerative colitis. It sucks. It's gross. Do I want it? No. Do I have it? Yes. Would I prefer not to? Well, there is one good thing. It keeps me home a lot. And I like being home.
So, scattered throughout today's episode, you'll find verbal selfies from the artist Robin O'Neill. Here's one more to get us started.
Before I even got my period, I asked my mom about a hysterectomy. I found out the whole deal. I was like, I don't need this. I want stuffed animals and maybe some cats in my future. So why do I need to have a period? There's absolutely no reason. It's a waste of my time.
We'll hear more from Robin O'Neill later in the show. Now, back to Tommy Pico. Pico's 32 years old, and he's part of the Kumeyaay Nation. He came up on the Viejas Indian Reservation outside San Diego. Now he lives in Brooklyn, where he's been publishing zines, hosting poetry readings, and writing for the last 13 years. His first book-length poem is called IRL, and it's written in the form of one long text message. You might even call it an epic sext. The book chronicles Tommy's alter ego, Teebs, who's a juiced-up version of himself, struggling through a post-college haze, and this is his own description of boys, burgers, and booze. But Pico and his character in IRL contend with more than just the exigencies of Grindr.
When you're born indigenous and you're so obscured from the rest of the world and you're so isolated, like you might as well not even be alive because nobody gives a fuck. And when you're a poet, you might as well not be a poet because nobody gives a fuck. But it's like, no, that task is to become a part of that conversation. A task is to become a part of the greater world. And a task is to have your motherfucking voice heard. That's all.
Tommy was raised in a family that fights for indigenous rights. His father was once the tribal chairman of his reservation. Tommy's brother is a tribal council member at the nearby Manzanita Indian Reservation, and his mom works for the EPA there. The Kumeyaay people live in what is now Southern California and Baja California in Mexico. They've endured colonization under Spanish missionaries, attacks from the Mexican government, and as Benjamin Madley points out in his book American Genocide, under U.S. rule, in the span of less than 30 years, California's Native American population plunged from about 150,000 to 30,000. And so what sort of life should you lead when you're living generations after your religion, language, and history have been taken from you and your family? With that kind of trauma as your inheritance, how do you build an identity in the contemporary world? Tommy's answer is to update the familiar figure of the Native American.
There are just a few representations of Indian people that have trickled down into pop culture. One of them is the noble savage. One of them is the squaw. One of them is like the horseback warrior. And one of them is like the sad Indian, the one whose religion and spirituality and land and resources and livelihood has been taken away from them. So I feel like I want to write in defiance of the sad Indian. You know what I mean? Like, it's like humor is rarely just lighthearted, fun banter. Usually it is laying the groundwork for a kind of hard truth that is sometimes difficult to look at directly. So humor is a way of like opening the reader up to something really difficult. And for me, it's usually like the fact that like I'm an indigenous person in occupied America and I walk around like that all the time. When I go outside of my door, I know that when other people pass Skull Street, they see Skull Street, but I see a massacre and I can't unsee that. And so those are things that I have to write about. And in order to get people to understand what my perspective is, usually I just got to open up with a joke. And then they start to trust me a little bit. And then I take their attention and I smash it in their faces.
We are mixed blood, but full Indian. I could see, my date says squinting, half Asian? Though everyone can yell, I mean tell I'm a fag. Part of me in sharp relief, a part of me half hidden. It's very Indian to watch Abfab because we're Indian and we're watching Abfab. You aren't very Indian, so when you watch Abfab, it isn't very Indian. There's no such thing as Indian, but there is an internalized kingdom of gnashing hands.
I think I read somewhere that it's like very common for a lot of the strongest, most personal racism, if that is a thing, happens against Indian people, happens on the borderlands of Indian reservations. And unfortunately, we had to take the bus to school with this group of like neo-Nazis who would wear shirts that said, "White revolution is the solution," and who generally made life pretty shitty for a lot of different people. But in particular, me and my cousins were just constantly butting heads with them. There are many ways in which Indian people get traumatized by their history. There are ways in which, you know, you internalize or inherit trauma. I feel like one of my first experiences of actual trauma was having to be on the bus with these people, and like that I developed morning sickness. Like I would dry heave on the way to school because I just didn't know what to do with like the fear that I felt. So there was a day I had to walk by one of these people, and there had been some confrontations with my cousin Rainbow and one of the white girls. And I had my backpack over one shoulder because I was cool. And it slid in front of me and it hit one of the guys in the face. And he was like the biggest one. I'm sure he was probably a super senior. I think he'd been held back a couple of times. And, you know, I was just this fat dorky freshman. And he like stood up and he was like, "What the fuck?" And my cousin Kevin, I think it was like, "Leave him alone. He's just a kid." And like, then there was like this ruckus and then like stuff started really popping off. I didn't take part in it. I was just like huddled in the corner, like, you know, trying to protect my chakras and everything or whatever, and my face. But then all of those neo-Nazi kids ended up getting expelled, and a bunch of my cousins ended up getting expelled as well, which meant that like I suddenly didn't have a tribe anymore. When I was at school, I was suddenly like exposed and open and vulnerable. I was out there all alone. And that's when I started to make friends with all the weirdos and the lesbians and the riot girls and the poets or whatever. That's when I started to, well, and because I was getting threatened all the time, I would eat my lunch in the library. So I would read a lot, you know? And that at that time, it wasn't just like racial. It was also, I was, you know, coming into my fag voice or whatever. So like, I was just like, you know, coming into a sexuality that I knew further alienated me from people around me. And so I retreated into myself.
I hate having my picture taken. I say to this photographer at this party, because every damn party has to be photographed, otherwise it doesn't happen. And because the parties are so boring, if people weren't posing, there'd be nothing to do but drink. It's too loud for convos and they don't let you dance in the city. He says, "Oh, come on." I say calmly, "No." And he asks, "Is this an Indian thing? Like, does a pig steal your soul or something?" I want to crumple him up in the palm of my hand, but I guess it is an Indian thing in the sense that I'm Indian and I'm doing this thing.
After the break, how to be a Native American poet in the age of the internet. We'll be right back. And now, back to Tommy Pico.
It was hard for me to get in front of people, in front of audiences, to get on a stage and to read in front of them. I had the worst stage fright, and I understand that now is in part a cultural inheritance. You know, in part, it's like, I would see people when I grew up, like, close off around white people, you know, get quieter around white people. I think that's probably why some people get this stereotype in their head of like some kind of stoic Indian or whatever. And it's because as soon as you went away, we were laughing again. You know, as soon as you went away, we were telling our stories again, we were singing again, we were playing games again. But when other people would come around, it was just like, I felt like seizing up. In order to survive, the only reason why I'm even here doing this is because I came from people who were really adept at hiding from the government. Survival itself just became the most radical act that any Kumeyaay person could do. And not just the government, but the locals, you know, just like staying in the mountains, keeping into the valleys, retreating when people would come, and staying quiet, being subservient, converting to Catholicism. There were policies enacted so that people could be, so that people couldn't speak their own language. My grandmother was forced into an Indian boarding school and was beaten if she spoke Kumeyaay. And there was a deep shame sewn inside of her for just being who she was. So that when my dad came around, she didn't pass the language on to him. And she didn't pass the traditional customs on to him, I think in a large part because she became, there was an internalized shame zone inside of her. And I feel that. I mean, it's been passed down to me implicitly, like genetics. And I write in defiance of that.
I'm horrified at the internet. Like alcoholism, oppressive and consuming occupier god, plus friends posting about suicide. Not like famous suicides or like Wilkes, who says when the world goes to shit, she and her cat Chairman Meow are going headfirst into the oven, which is romantic. No. Like actually committing suicide. Like Darren in 7th grade with motor oil, or my Uncle Stoney with the shotgun, or Gio and Beam and Guadalupe. 3 siblings each shook from life in different car wrecks. Each, what's it called? Risk-seeking behavior? Each of them a kind of suicide that we don't talk about as suicide because we're Indian. And who's listening?
Sometimes I feel like in ways that I have not been able to anticipate, I carry ancient Kumeyaay, I don't know, juju inside of me. I realized it while I was writing my book. And the reason why I'm attracted to long form work is because some of the last remaining vestiges of Kumeyaay culture in the Americas are this song cycle called the Bird Songs, which is my namesake. My Kumeyaay name means bird song in English. Kumeyaay bird songs are a collection of songs that talk about how Kumeyaay people traveled through the world and came to the valley that we live in now. I realized that the poem is my journey, from the reservation to New York. And that's how I knew it was a bird song. And that's how I knew that the world wasn't making me whiter. I was making the world more Kumeyaay. And when I realized that, I just started crying because I felt so connected to people who came before me, who sacrificed everything. That's when I realized that no matter what the United States government, the Spanish government, the Mexican government had done to try to rob me of my magic, my magic as an indigenous person, it was still there. It was just waiting for me to see it, to really look at it. And that made me feel essentially Kumeyaay. And that, oh my God, that was probably the moment where I realized that I had a purpose in life and that I wanted to live.
That piece was produced by Christina Loring, a radio producer and artist living in San Francisco. The music you're hearing is a Kumeyaay bird song, like the ones that Tommy was raised on. If you want to learn more about Kumeyaay history and culture, go to kumeyaay.com. That's KUMEYAAY.com. Tommy Pico's debut book of poetry, IRL, is out now from a small press called Birds LLC. His next book, called Nature Poem, comes out later this spring from Tin House. If you want to hear more from Tommy Pico, subscribe to his newsletter at tinyletter.com/heyteebs. Teebs is T-E-E-B-S. And now, here's another verbal selfie from Robin O'Neill.
Anyway, I got a tip for you. Actually, Lieutenant Joe Kenda of Homicide Hunter has a good tip for you. You ready?
I worked it out once, just out of curiosity. What is the time people get killed? It worked out to 1:21 in the morning on a Tuesday. So if it's Tuesday and it's 1:21 a.m., lock yourself in a closet.
Murder, solving a murder for homicide detectives, the process of that is eerily similar to how I feel about solving 2D images. Joe Kenda, he describes this process better than I've ever heard any artist describing their process. This makes sense to me.
Picture a murder case as a spinning top on a table. It's made to spin. It spins absolutely perfectly. You, as a detective, should stand there and admire it for as long as is necessary to decide the parameters of this case. If you touch it too quickly, too firmly in the wrong place, it scoots off that table and it disappears. And you never get it back.
The Organist is produced by me with Ross Simonini. Our managing editor is Ben Bush. Our contributing editors are Jenny Amint, Naila Orr, David Weinberg, and Mike Dodge Weisskopf. Our editor at KCRW is Nick White. We're mixed and engineered at KCRW by Mario Diaz and Kat Yore. Our interns are Claire Boyle, Aaron Pelish, and Will Howard. We'll be back with a new episode in 2 weeks. If you like The Organist, subscribe to The Organist in Stitcher or Pocket Casts or whatever you like to do to gather together your little podcast somewhere. Please also leave us a rating and a review, though, in iTunes. Our iTunes review page has become somehow the hottest place on the internet to go just on a Saturday night. Just go there, hang out, You can find reviews, for example, like this one from an organist listener called Jimmy Chen. Let's hear it.
The difference between discomfort and pain is both rhetorical and subjective. I can say that, for me, listening to the organist is somewhat painful. I have a large head. My headphones strain to encompass its width, and thus the ear pads press the temples of my glasses into their respective temporal bones. Despite this, my birth was a gentle one. I was delivered swiftly at some point between lunch and dinner, at least according to my mother, when she regales her friends with accounts of how reasonable a son I am. My cranial girth developed in adolescence, a time when, for a lot of boys, things increase in size. Where other men may flaunt the ostensible size of their members, I remain utterly neutral about my large head. The growth of a body has many causes. Would I brag about a cyst? And while one may think that I would enjoy correlating the size of a head to the size of a mind, I don't think it marks me as a person of intelligence. I am instead continuously humbled by various notions. For example, the word organ comes from the Greek organon, meaning tool or instrument. Many of us don't think of the brain as an organ, at least not in the way a liver or kidney is, because sentience or consciousness has been abstracted to such a degree by the very people invested in it. By contrast, the pipe organ, after which this podcast is named, derives from orgia, from the Greek again, which meant religious performance. This lends itself to the association that developed between the bodily organ and the pipes through which more ecclesiastical winds coursed. I say this not to be pedantic, but as an example of both the contents and limits of my capacious head.
You can find more Organist fan fiction on our email newsletter, which lives in a two-bedroom apartment with all previous episodes of The Organist at kcrw.com/theorganist. And thanks to the immortal Edgar Oliver for bringing Jimmy Chen's iTunes review to life. Before we go, let's hear one more verbal selfie from Robin O'Neill. And if you like these, you should listen to Robin's podcast, which is called Me Reading Stuff. It's excellent. Thanks for listening.
People keep commenting to me that my outros, that's what I call them, on my podcast sound like benedictions, like church benedictions. And so I'm kind of compiling some of the ones that people have mentioned to me that they write down. And this is the one that the most people have commented on.
Remember, when you stop being a people pleaser, people stop being pleased. You guys, go water your plants, go do your stretches, go clean up your makeup brushes, log your calories into MyFitnessPal, pay your Netflix bill, write a fan letter, measure your dresser to see if it fits on that other wall, order that writing desk you've always wanted, put it against that wall, put a plant on it, start a novel, keep dying, keep writing it down. I love you guys. Good night.